Hola, so this afternoon we return to the practice, the meditative cultivation of equanimity. I commented yesterday the obvious truth that it's very easy for us to engage in an I-it relationship with other people who are not simply its. That is, the body is an it, appearances are its, but people are subjects, so they're not its. As we can do this with other people, and then that arises as the basis for attachment for the pleasant its and hostility or aversion for the unpleasant its. As that can happen towards other people, is it not also true that it can happen internally? And that is, when we speak of self-loathing, self-contempt, low self-esteem, if there's something rather odd about that, to my mind, and that is, if I feel really bad about myself, if I don't like myself, how many people are there in here? Which one is it that doesn't like the other one? And isn't there a sense of superiority when I look and said, I'm such a schmuck? Isn't the person who's thinking that a little bit better than the schmuck that he just judged? So how many people are there in there? It looks like at least two. And what's happening, is it not the case that when I think, oh, I'm such a whatever, you know, jerk, whatever, selfish person, I'm such a hot-tempered person, whatever, how do you say, derogative comment we make about ourselves, it seems to me that it is a perfect instance, that is, to say, a classic instance of itifying oneself, just turning oneself into an unpleasant object from a superior vantage point and looking down on oneself as that's the one I don't like. But it happens not only for self-loathing, low self-esteem, lack of self-worth, and so forth, but on some occasions, at least some people, feel pretty good about themselves. Self-infatuation, looking into the mirror and saying, looking good. Or do some, you know, maybe you're a photographer, you look at your photographer, man, I am hot, I'm such a good photographer, I'm such a great cook, I am really something. And now there's one more it. And this is a pleasant it. We're applauding the it, you know, as if we're watching a show. And so we can itify, we can objectify, we can flatten ourselves in an agreeable fashion, in which case we become objects of attachment for ourselves. We can be also objects of aversion for ourselves. And on other occasions, we can simply say, man, you're a boring person. I don't really care much about you one way or another. You're just so boring, whatever. You know, just flat. Not having any real feeling one way or another about this person who happens to be oneself. And so one more itifying, one more just locking into an object that is neither agreeable nor disagreeable. Looking in the mirror and say, well, you're okay. That's pretty much it. You just got C, you know, just flat. You're passing, that's all. And so There's a statement in at least one of the mind trainings, the Lojong within the Tibetan tradition. I think it comes explicitly in the seven-point mind training, but it's a theme that crops up elsewhere on many occasions. And that is, view all others' faults as your own. View all others' faults as your own. Well, obviously, there are serial killers, there are rapists, there are mass murderers, and so forth, and these are not faults, probably, of any person in this room. So we can say, but that's not a fault of mine, I haven't killed hundreds of people, and so forth. Fair enough, that's obviously true. But the fault of malice, of self-justification, of cruelty, of brutality, and so forth, we probably know what these words mean, based upon our own experience. And so when Geshe Chekawa, or it traces back to Atisha, makes this comment, view all others' faults as one's own. I think what he's getting at here is that when it comes to other people's faults, and of course other people have faults just as we do, so there's no pretense that we're the only faulty person in the universe, that's just silly. Other people have faults, but when we try to make sense of, we try to understand, but make sense of is probably the best way of phrasing. Make sense of other people's faults so that we kind of get it. Oh, I understand. This is your fault. You're selfish, or you're greedy, or you're arrogant, or you're ungrateful, or what have you. Whatever comes to mind as we paint the person in our substrate, we're like the artist painting the image of this person. I think the crucial point here that Atisha, Chekhov, and many other great masters are getting at is we're like artists, and as we paint the faults of other people, we're painting those faults from the palette of our own minds, of our own experience. And so if somebody engages in evil that we can't even comprehend, we can't comprehend it. And so when we try to imagine it, all we'll be able to do is approximate based upon our own experience. That's about as far as I can get, and then I guess there's something beyond that. But we can't really get it because we don't know it, right? And so quite literally, when we bring to mind other people's faults, they are faults that we have projected based upon our own experience. And they are, in fact, our own faults. It's not to say that nobody else has those faults, but whenever we think of those other people, we are, in fact, painting in the substrate of our own minds. Now, there's a symmetry in all of this, a symmetry that runs through all of karma, and this symmetry runs here as well. What is the depth, if I can take a rather strong example, what's the depth of the compassion of a person like the Dalai Lama? What's the scope? What's the quality of the Dalai Lama's compassion? And my answer is, I don't know. I really don't know. I see him, I see his warmth, I see his kindness, I see the effect he has on other people. I see how he engages with me, and it just, whoa, such compassion, really. I mean, it's so simple, it's really obvious, but such compassion. But when I try to paint the Dalai Lama and try to imagine the compassion of the Dalai Lama, I can't leap beyond my substrate into his mind and just pluck out Dalai Lama's compassion. I can't get tweezers and go into his mind stream and say, whoa, that's the degree of compassion he has. Like, whoa, you know, have a heart attack. Can't do that. I can only evaluate, get a sense of his compassion within the parameters of what I've experienced or imagined. So if it's true that all the faults of others are in fact our own faults, it's probably equally true that when we think of the virtues of others, we're drawing from the same palette. We are the artist drawing from the same palette of our own experience, which means I would say with a lot of confidence, the depth, the scope, the quality of the Dalai Lama's compassion to me is simply inconceivable. That's not just saying it's, you know, infinite or whatever. Maybe it's infinite, but what it really is saying is a factual statement. It's inconceivable because I'm utterly convinced that the depth of his compassion surpasses my own. Gee, go figure, you know? And so there it is. But now what I'm getting at here is as we, in yesterday's practice, brought to mind a person that we found very attractive and dwelled on that person's attractive qualities, what were those attractive qualities? From our own palate. When we brought to mind another person we find very disagreeable and we dwelled on the very disagreeable, the maybe even disgusting qualities of that person, drawing on our own palate and painting the person from our own palate, right? And then out comes the aversion. But where are these images coming from? As we brought one person to mind, we brought another person to mind. Where are those images appearing? Where are they appearing? What's their location? Yeah, your mind, or just be, yeah, that's correct, or I'm fishing for a word. Substrate. They're not coming from anywhere outside your own substrate, right? Your dreams are taking place entirely within your substrate. All of these sensory impressions, as I gaze at the peach color of Mugi's shirt and so forth, all these sensory impressions, auditory and so forth, they're all arising in the substrate. When I think of Venerable Tsepela and so forth, when I think of her, what kind of a nun is she, what kind of a person, all the images, all the thoughts and so forth, memories, are arising from my substrate. And so in a way, it's very personal. When we bring other people to mind, we're bringing them to mind, but we're inviting them into our own homes, into our own substrate. And then we bring this home and say, okay, well, let's just look in my own home when I'm the only one there. When I'm the only one there. And I'm evaluating, I'm getting a sense, I'm relating to myself. Am I a person that I like, that I'm attached to, that I feel, you know, oh, good on you? Or am I a person I really don't even like being in the same home with? Just feeling uncomfortable, oh, every morning, oh, you again, ugh, you know? Whatever it is, it's coming out of the substrate. So whether it's our awareness of other people, whether it's our self-awareness, it's all manifesting in the same place, and it's all being painted with it from the same palette. So what I'd like to do this morning, or this afternoon, is a variation on the theme of equanimity, But see what it might be like to overcome the I-it relationship with ourselves. To recognize how it manifests, those occasions when we just can't stand ourselves. It's not that we can't stand the deed, I did this, but I just can't stand the person, right? And that's where the self-loathing, so low self-esteem, self-contempt, and so forth comes in. There are other times we may be very attached to ourselves. I'm so smart, I'm so this, I'm so that, you know, and now it's an object of attachment. And other times, just flat-out indifference. Just don't really care, you know, live or die, whatever, that's your problem. You know, just flat. And so overcoming this I-it relationship and seeing how we conceive of ourselves in different ways, wildly different ways, from reprehensible to utterly laudable, you know, really noble, and they're probably all true on occasion, but look at the bandwidth, just as from our worst enemy to our dearest friend, and see that we are all of that. On occasion, I've been my worst enemy. On occasion, I've been my best friend. On occasion, I don't really care whether I live in the same state or not with, you know, that guy. You know, and overcome the I-it relationship with ourselves. And then we're really honing in on these original teachings of the Buddha. In developing loving kindness, where do you start? Buddha's teachings, what did he say? With yourself, yeah. And he said, one who loves himself will never harm another. So I think this is really pretty core. If we can really be, how do you say, melting away the I-it relationship internally, so that we love ourselves, we have a sense of caring, of affection, of warmth, of really wishing ourselves well, even when our minds are dominated by mental afflictions, even when you engage in really unwholesome actions. We may really deplore the unwholesome action, but not deplore the person, and have compassion for ourselves when under the domination of mental afflictions we do really unwholesome things. Compassion for ourselves when the mind is just dominated, it feels just attacked by one mental affliction after another. I think we all know what that's like. Compassion for ourselves when we just seem boring, nothing special at all, just neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, not appealing, not unappealing, nothing special. Having a sense of affection, of warmth and closeness for that person. And likewise, same thing when we appear to ourselves as someone admirable and feeling, well, sure, that's an admirable appearance, but having that connection with ourselves as a sentient being and wishing ourselves well. So, shall we try equanimity with respect to ourselves? Is that a question? Sure, go ahead. Yeah.
This is helping me in my progress.
Very true.
I'm doing something bad.
Yes.
So if I don't reflect on it,
yes.
It's not helping me in my progress. So in a way, you know, my own view, my
sure.
reflective capabilities
sure.
are a tool to help me.
Absolutely, yes. So the question here, since you don't have a mic, and that is a very valid point from Angela, and that is when we do something that is really worthwhile, to appreciate that, to take delight in it, to even praise ourselves, that can provide inspiration. On the other hand, when we do something clearly, the mind is dominated by mental affliction, we're thoughtless, we're selfish, what have you, then to feel remorse for that, to feel some displeasure, some distancing, this is also a good thing. Exactly right. And this pertains exactly to the last of the four immeasurables, empathetic joy. And it comes to the same point. And that is, if I do something really wholesome, after whatever it may be, don't need to give an example. If I do something really wholesome, and then afterwards I reflect upon the deed, and I take delight in it, how good. That's what makes life meaningful. I've offered something good to the world. This makes life meaningful. This is good. This is excellent, wonderful. Carry on. All of that is called empathetic joy, or rejoicing in one's own virtue, which, as Tsongkhapa said, the greatest way to increase your own virtue is by delighting in it. But you notice where the focus was. It was on the deed. Now, I can take that in, you see? It's the same point. I can do something generous, and then afterwards I can feel, I am such a generous person. I'm much more generous than that person, and I'm certainly better, more generous than that person. I am really quite superior to most people when it comes to generosity. And also humility. I really think I'm exceptionally humble. Most people are not nearly as humble as I am. Because yesterday I had this episode of humility, and I was really humble, more so than anybody about me. They were all very arrogant compared to me. You know? So it's focusing on the deed and it's taking delight in that, and then it's clean, and there's no pumping up of the reification of delusion of I am, and I just happen to be this, and I happen to be that. So the focus is on the deed, and likewise, and so importantly, the distinction between very meaningful remorse for an unwholesome deed and crippling guilt for oneself as being a deplorable, reprehensible person who's probably just built that way, intrinsically just kind of a scoundrel, bad person, in which case we're hopeless. So your point's very well taken, but the emphasis goes to the deed, yeah. And that's exactly, so now we see the connection between the empathetic joy and meaningful remorse and this one here. And that is, it's not itifying, it's not turning a person into a deed, into an object, an event, but taking a person, including this one here, ourselves, as a sentient being. So, excellent point. Okay? Oh, Kathleen, carry on. Yes.
With faults of others would be coming from the psyche, not the substrate.
Oh, sure.
My view was that the substrate being lower,
mm-hmm.
much lower,
yeah.
than the psyche,
yes.
doesn't fully contain that kind of detail, if you will. In other words, and we're always shooting for the substrate because we want to get down to that level of goodness and non-conceptuality.
Sure.
That doesn't contain all that stuff. That
mm-hmm. Huh? Yes and no. Just as Angeles was yes and no. Yes, very good point, and modify. And yours is the same thing. Yes and modify. And that is, it is not correct to think that the substrate consciousness is intrinsically virtuous. Yigigyun tamode, ranshiki geomare. Ranshiki geomare. It's not intrinsically virtuous. If you settle into it with clarity, you'll see it's blissful, but bliss is not a virtue. It's not a virtue. I mean, there's all kinds of bliss. Bliss itself is not a virtuous state of mind. It's just bliss, right? It's a very happy state of mind, but simply experiencing bliss is not accruing greater virtue. It's not propelling you along the path to enlightenment. Likewise, luminosity. A person who's scared to death will have a high degree of luminosity, but that's not a virtue. It's just very bright, high-resolution mind. And likewise, non-conceptuality. A person who's brain-dead, vegetative, may be experiencing non-conceptuality that doesn't take them any closer to enlightenment. So none of those three qualities are intrinsically virtuous in the Buddhist sense of the term, as in the sense of propelling one along the path to enlightenment, giving rise to really beneficial karmic repercussions. Buddha nature, yes, intrinsically virtuous. But substrate consciousness is simply blissful, luminous, and non-conceptual. Now, when you're resting there, just resting in the substrate consciousness, are you having a whole bunch of images arising of nasty people and happy people and nice and all of that kind of stuff? Is it just cluttered with a whole population of all the colors of your pastel, of your palette? The answer is no. It's blissful, it's luminous, and it's non-conceptual. At the same time, the words lend themselves to reification. I would simply invite you not to reify. The substrate consciousness is, in a manner of speaking, the repository for all your memories, your karma, your tendencies, your gifts, and so forth. It is the carrier. It is the carrier. And so, for example, when you slip into the substrate consciousness in deep, dreamless sleep, while you're there, it's just a vacuity. It's a symmetry, it's internally homogeneous. Then that symmetry is broken, and then, lo and behold, out comes a dream. And a whole dream plays itself out with people that are familiar, with emotions that are familiar. You'll see very angry people, very pleasant people, generous, virtuous, non-virtuous, and so forth. You'll experience all kinds of people in the dream, and you may be all kinds of people yourself in the dream, virtuous on one occasion, non-virtuous on another. Where's it all coming from? The substrate. Your question is correct. That is, your statement is correct. And that, so, in other words, you're wrong that you're wrong. You're right. That when we are drawing from our palate and we're trying to make sense of other people, where's the palate? When I try to imagine you, when I try to imagine you, I consciously think, what kind of a person is Kathleen? And I remember our conversations, some email and so forth, and I conjure up something. Where's the palate? My psyche, no question about it. My psyche, right? But where's the palate of the psyche come from? From my substrate. And so, on the surface level, yes, the palate is consciously being drawn. That is, we're consciously drawing from the palate of our conscious waking mind, which is the psyche. But all the stuff of the psyche is being held and sustained and carried by the substrate consciousness. Okay? So the psyche emerges from the substrate consciousness. It implodes back into it, falling asleep, shamatha, dying, and so forth. It emerges out when we wake up, when we start dreaming, and so forth. But the psyche is not something radically other than or separate from the substrate. It is more a crystallization of the innate luminosity, the transparency, the limpidity of the substrate consciousness. It's a crystallization of it, but it's not something separate. As we'll see, I'm going to make a little footnote to the question that Noah raised yesterday, but I'm not going to go there now. But as the psyche is like a crystallization of the substrate consciousness, so is the substrate consciousness, in the manner of speaking, a crystallization of Rigpa. Of Rigpa, the deepest dimension. They're not separate. They're not just the three things slapped together, but it's emergence giving rise to emergence. Okay? But you're still right. And that is, when we imagine the people around us, we read the news, we're trying to make sense of the world. We're drawing there in the conscious state of the mind, the ordinary psyche. That's where our palate is. And so when we try to imagine the Dalai Lama, we try to imagine an Osama bin Laden, we try to imagine Hu Jintao, whoever it may be, and what's going on in their mind. Why did they do that? Why did they do that? You know, well, we're drawing on the palate of our own psyche. But that palate has its roots in the substrate consciousness. Okay? Good. Let's jump in. Two very good questions. Hopefully we'll clarify the practice. Let's go for one session. Remembering the different meanings of the word upeksha, or equanimity. We begin the practice, as we've begun all other sessions, by settling the body, then the speech, and the mind in a quality of equanimity, of balance, of equipoise. This is exactly what it means to settle the body in its natural state. As your awareness fills the body, and you set the body at ease. Relaxed, comfortable. You let the body be still. And assume, even if only psychologically, a posture of vigilance. The balance is there. It is the balance between vigilance and relaxation, sustained with the fulcrum of stability or stillness. It's not a static equanimity or equipoise. It's alive. It's energetic. It's poised. And likewise, settling the speech in its natural state, a state of equipoise by way of settling the respiration in its natural rhythm. This too is a matter of balance, not tipping over into breathing effortfully or breathing in a strained fashion, or in terms of inhibiting or constraining the breath. Neither forcing it nor inhibiting it. Let the breath flow evenly of its own accord. And let your inner voice settle gently, effortlessly, in a state of equilibrium, of equipoise, that is one of effortless silence. and the way to settle more and more deeply in such a state of equilibrium is by relaxing more and more deeply, letting go with each out-breath, in body, speech, and mind, releasing. Settle your mind in a state of equipoise. In Tibetan it's called nyamsha, an even placing. It is once again a type of equanimity in which you set your mind at ease, in stillness, and you balance the sense of relaxation with the quality of clarity, of vividness of your attention. And for a little while, let your awareness illuminate the sensations of the in and out breath, calm and soothe the mind for a little while with mindfulness of breathing. Now let's move from this more passive mode of awareness, emphasizing the cognizant aspect of consciousness, and draw more from the luminous aspect of consciousness, luminosity manifesting by way of creativity, imagination, memory, intelligence, the more dynamic quality of the mind. And reflect upon yourself, how you conceive of yourself, or the manifold ways in which over time you have reflected upon yourself and who you are. Think back and recall, have there been occasions when you brought yourself to mind, you thought of yourself, and you regarded yourself as being really quite unexceptional, ordinary, nothing special at all. Neither especially good or agreeable, but neither disagreeable or unpleasant or non-virtuous either. Just nothing special. Have there been such occasions when you feel whether you live or die really doesn't matter much one way or another? Because you're really not a person of much significance. In other words, have you ever objectified yourself as someone towards whom you feel indifferent? You have become the stranger to yourself. Neither attractive nor unattractive, neither arousing attachment or aversion. In such ways we may objectify ourselves and reify ourselves as being intrinsically ordinary. And yet you know better. However you manifest from one day to the next, one deed to the next, you are a sentient being, and the yearning for happiness and freedom from suffering is continuous. And you are imbued with a Buddha nature, the capacity for freedom, for awakening, an infinite wellspring of virtue. You are indeed worthy of happiness, and you have the potential for freedom. With each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness from this orb of light at your heart and wish yourself well. May this person, myself, may you be well and happy. May you find the happiness that is your heart's desire. With each out-breath, imagine this light suffusing, embracing this person. May your own inner purity be unveiled. May you tap into the wellsprings of genuine happiness within. And imagine this person, here and now, actually finding such happiness, being truly well and happy. And let this appearance of yourself dissolve back into the space of your mind, back into the substrate. Drawing once again from your memory, think back to see if there's any time when you've really thought quite well of yourself. Perhaps your physical appearance, your intelligence, your creativity, your behavior. As you reflect upon yourself, feeling, I'm something of a cut above. I'm something a bit special. I really am quite good. Maybe even quite extraordinary. And allow yourself to linger on your extraordinary qualities, your virtues, physical, perhaps virtues of the speech, virtues of the mind, qualities that make you very agreeable to yourself. I really like myself as this person who appears to your mind as an object. Examine this self-image quite closely and see what an artistic creation it is, having carved away that which does not conform to this image, this self-image, such that the image is quite homogeneously good, attractive, agreeable, admirable, having chiseled away everything that isn't. And then identifying with this image, that's me. And I really am something special. Couldn't live without myself. Whether these recollections of virtues are accurate, whether they're fictitious or simply exaggerations, they are, after all, only images and appearances. And there's a person behind that veil who, through all the vicissitudes of life, through virtues and non-virtues, constantly wishes to be happy and to be free of suffering, and is worthy of such freedom and of such joy. See through the veneer. See through the roles you've taken on, the image that you like to project to the world. See through to the person, and with each out-breath arouse a yearning, may you be well. May you, as myself, may you be well and happy, and may you be free of suffering and its causes. And breathe out the light of love and kindness. And imagine with each out-breath, this person, yourself, actually experiencing such well-being, finding the happiness that is your heart's desire. Authentic happiness, and not simply the appearances, the facades, the facsimiles of happiness. Allow the appearance to dissolve into the space of the mind. And now once again draw from memory. Have there ever been occasions when you simply couldn't stand yourself? You were disgusted at yourself, felt repelled, embarrassed, maybe even hatred, feeling you're not even worthy of happiness. Bring to mind how you envision yourself on such occasions and allow yourself to dwell for a little while on those repellent qualities or behavior that you've exhibited on occasion, and allow the disgust, even the contempt, to arise for this objectification of yourself. Now penetrate through the veil with the awareness that even in the worst of times, when the mind is most heavily encumbered by, enslaved by the afflictions of the mind, even when we engage in the most deplorable behavior that is truly harmful, even in the worst of times, there's still a sentient being there. Misguided, deluded, and yet still seeking for happiness, wishing for freedom from suffering, and doing his or her best to find it, worthy of compassion and worthy of loving kindness in every moment. See through the veil of disagreeable appearances to the person who is you, and with each out-breath breathe out the light of compassion. May you be free of suffering, free of mental afflictions that lie at the root of suffering, and free of unwholesome behavior that compounds and prolongs suffering. Breathe out the purity of loving kindness and imagine the darkness of suffering and its causes being dispelled. And imagine this person becoming free, utterly and irreversibly free of suffering and its causes. Release all appearances and all objects to the mind. Release all aspirations. Withdraw your awareness from all appearances and for a moment let your awareness rest in its own place. Resting in awareness of awareness. Let's bring the session to a close. Hola, so. Just by the way I've been ending each of these meditations on the Four Immeasurables, this is taken from a text I had the privilege of translating called Transforming Felicity and Adversity into the Spiritual Path by a great Dzogchen master, extraordinary scholar as well as contemplative by the name of Dodipchen Jime Tenpe Nyima. I lived in the late 19th, early 20th century. He wrote this beautiful little lojong entirely couched within the context of Dzogchen. And so as he went through one meditation after another, then at least on one, I think more than one occasion, then he would end the meditation with just this moment of releasing all appearances. And I just liked it so much. So I'm just proliferating that. But I didn't make it up. I hope it's obvious that in each of these four measurables, and now we've tapped into each of the four, that there's just so much wisdom in them. There's so much good sense, intelligence, but real wisdom, that it's these virtues of the heart, but wisdom just saturates them. That is my impression. And so I stand really in deep reverence of these practices, the teachings in which they're embedded. But I think it's ever so important we do handle them with finesse, with some delicacy, with some precision. Precision, the type of precision that was raised in the dialogue with Angala. That yes, there's time for rejoicing in our virtues. Yes, there's time for really feeling remorse for our actions, but then not just compounding self-infatuation or self-contempt. And so that's some precision there. And so On this point, there's, of course, over the last 50 years, there's been an unprecedented kind of movement of Buddhism, which in some ways has been really wonderful because it's reached many, many people. In other ways, I think not so wonderful. The popularization, when people doing it really don't know Buddhism very well, and then they're really trying to, all seems to me like they're just trying to make sure they don't say anything about Buddhism that people don't want to hear. Like, also as if they're selling it, you know, like merchandise. That have to make, you know, put a really good face. This is a really good product. Let's see if we can sell it. And I think one of the selling points I've heard, well, I'll tell you one. I just saw an excerpt from a film on the Buddha just recently. And one of the commentators, apparently speaking as an authority on Buddhism, said, and the Buddha as a young man confronted really in a very deep way the realities of aging, sickness, and death. And apprehending these, he saw that he had to come to a way of viewing that so that they are really okay. I think marijuana would do that. Really, it really would. Just, you know, get high, stay high, and then getting aging, well, I can still get high. You know, you get sick, I can still get high. I'm dying, well, I can still get high. I mean, really, if that's all it was about, I mean, I cringed when I heard that. It was such a wild misrepresentation of why the Buddha left this comfortable home and applied himself with such incredible intensity just to feel okay about, so that was one of the, but it sounds nice. Oh, I want to be okay about that. Maybe I should study Buddhism. And so there's that one, kind of, I mean, you can see it kind of got me. Simplifying is fine, but massively distorting, I think it's not so fine. There's another one I've heard frequently, and that is in meditation, especially when sometimes mindfulness is taught in such a way as whatever comes up in the mind, whether it's hatred, malice, jealousy, greed, arrogance, whatever comes up, just embrace it all, because these are parts of you and you have to embrace all of yourself. Otherwise, you'll be internally very conflicted and fragmented. So whatever comes up, just embrace it. You like that one? That sounds really nice. It's complete crap, but it sounds nice. Imagine taking that principle and applying it to nutrition. Whatever food comes along, rotten, indigestible, toxic, filled with arsenic, fungus, bacteria, just embrace it all, because it's just food, you know? It doesn't make any sense. Or consider your body. Oh, you have tuberculosis, that bacilli, well, it's part of you, tuberculosis. And you have the influenza, you have food poisoning. Oh, but that's part of you. Embrace the poison in your stomach. You know, it's just, I have such a reverence for the incredible wisdom of the Buddha Dharma, and when I'm seeing it being presented stupid, I must say, I get a little bit upset. The notion that when anger arises, that's me. That's already big wrong step. It's not me, it's just anger, right? And pettiness and all the other mental, they're not me, they're just mental afflictions, just like poison in my stomach is not part of me, it's poison in my stomach. Influenza virus is just influenza, it's not, oh, swine flu has now become part of me. Oh, embrace swine flu. Yes, I'm a swine flu-ish kind of person, you know. And so, why it comes up, I think, I mean, why do people like to hear that, and why do people like to reiterate it, which is completely incompatible with everything the Buddha said, and completely incompatible with every school of Buddhism, I think it comes in response, here's my speculation, it comes in response to this big, powerful, malignant tendency of modernity of judging ourselves. And the self-loathing and the criticism and the judgment, you're not good enough, you've gotten good enough, and saying, hey, you are good enough. And Buddhism is neither going to self-judgment, nor is it to embracing everything, all your mental afflictions are just swell, because they're your mental affliction. It's neither going to one of those extremes, right? It is embracing yourself as an individual, a sentient being looking for happiness, wishing to be of suffering. And so I think that's the good message, that is authentic. The Buddha did say it was okay to love yourself. It's actually something to be cultivated. It's a good thing, but he never said, love your mental afflictions. They're part of you, embrace them. He said just the opposite, right? Exactly the opposite. So there we are. But I think there's something in this equanimity applied to ourselves that may be really helpful. And that is when our minds do become dominated by a mental affliction of any sort. Just take the three usual suspects: craving, hostility, and delusion. When we see the mind has been dominated by them, and one of the metaphors used in Buddha Dhamma, classic Buddhist psychology, is that the mind, your mental awareness, is like a very, like a king who has no will of his own, really kind of wishy-washy, there's the word, a wishy-washy king, your mind, your mental awareness, like a wishy-washy king. And then the mental factors come in, and they're like cabinet ministers that come in. And so cabinet ministers, and one group of a cabinet comes in, and the cabinet consists of generosity and mindfulness and wisdom and equanimity and so forth. And they're all supporting the king, advising the king, and suddenly the king is a very virtuous king. And then unfortunately there's a palace coup. And then pettiness and greed and selfishness and anger and irritability, they come in. Out goes the previous cabinet, in comes the previous cabinet, and now this wishy-washy king is, you know, dominated by this new cabinet. So that's really a pretty close metaphor, and we have coup after coup after coup. And so at 5 o'clock, we may be acting in a very generous way. We say, whoa, this person's really a Dharma practitioner. That's at 5 o'clock. At 5:10, this person has never heard of Dharma. How selfish, how thoughtless, how mindless. And that's true then at 5:10. And it was also true at 5 o'clock. Oh, how mindful, how balanced, how sensitive, how thoughtful. Just a palace coup occurred in between. Right? And which one's the real me? Well, none of them are the real me. They're just mental factors arising and passing. But the point here is that it's pretty easy to like ourselves, to feel good about ourselves, content, inwardly content, which is important, having a sense of inner contentment. It's pretty easy when the mind is balanced, when we feel relaxed, that there's mindfulness, there's an openness, friendliness arises quite easily, then it's, oh, yeah, I'm a pretty nice guy. I can wake up with you tomorrow morning, be there, I'll be there with you, you know? But when the mind becomes dominated by irritability, by pettiness, by impatience, frustration, anger, and so forth, it's very easy on that occasion to be impatient with ourselves and thinking, wow, what a jerk, why didn't you just cool it? You idiot, come on, cool down. What an idiot. Why don't you just stop it, for heaven's sakes? You know? And then here we are, two people in there, one judging the other one. If, when the mind is dominated by mental afflictions, on those occasions, because it's not continuous or homogeneous, but when our own minds do become dominated by mental affliction, if we can feel compassion for ourselves then, right in the midst of it, that's really a boon. And what it's not is developing a friendly relationship with the mental afflictions. It is feeling compassion for ourselves as a sentient being who is temporarily, as if we just got swine flu or came down with tuberculosis, we've just gotten the disease, we've just gotten an affliction of the mind. It'll pass, but while it's there, it's very painful, and it can give rise to very negative results. Right there, exactly when the mind is dominated, if we can feel compassion and there can arise the yearning, may I be free, may I be free, that really is an opener. If we can do that towards ourselves, feeling a gentleness, a compassion for ourselves, when the mind is dominated by mental affliction, and then we walk out the door and we see somebody else whose mind apparently is dominated by mental affliction, judging by their behavior, then we've taken one step towards not simply objectifying this person as a jerk, an idiot, a disagreeable person, objectifying the person as somebody 100% negative, but maybe we can actually feel compassion for that person as we can for ourselves. But my own sense here is if I can't feel compassion for myself when my own mind is dominated by mental afflictions, what chance do I have of feeling compassion for anyone else? I don't even know what it tastes like. It's easy to feel compassion for someone who's suffering. But as Geshe Rabten, one of my primary teachers, told me so many years ago, he said, between a person who's an invalid in a wheelchair, physically really challenged, there, and another person over here who's in excellent physical condition, but really engaging in really negative, really unwholesome, harmful behavior. Between those two, the invalid and the person who's up there really doing some major damage in the world, which one's more worthy of compassion? The person sowing the seeds for misery and not the person simply reaping the harvest of some negative karma from past life. So I think those are really words of wisdom. So That's that.